Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org or on Facebook, Twitter, or our YouTube channel. I'm Sarah Symes, Senior Fellow of the Packard Foundation and your moderator this evening. Tonight's program is Up the Ladder, Women Pursuing Careers in Science and Technology. Generously underwritten by Wells Fargo. Now it is my pleasure to introduce our three distinguished panelists, Dr. Diane Wara, Dr. Hilary Seligman, and Eva Cole. Dr. Diane Wara is Emeritus Professor of Pediatrics at UCSF, where she has taught and practiced medicine for 45 years, an elected member of the National Academy of Sciences and the Institute of Medicine. Dr. Wara is an immunologist interested in genetic causes and pediatric HIV/AIDS, specifically on how to stop transmission of HIV from mother to child. She is, also was Associate Dean for Women's Affairs at UCSF, where she worked to create a more family-friendly infrastructure for UCSF faculty and staff. On this panel, Dr. Wara represents the senior scientist. Dr. Hilary Seligman is an associate professor of medicine at UCSF and a core faculty member for the Center for Vulnerable Populations at San Francisco General Hospital. She won an Essential Core Training Award at UCSF School of Medicine twice in the last 3 years and provides primary patient care while researching how poverty influences the presentation and management of chronic disease. She focuses on federal nutrition programs, food affordability and access, and income-related drivers of food choice as they impact the prevention and management of obesity and diabetes. On this panel, Dr. Seligman represents the mid-career scientist. Eva Cole is a high school senior from Holy Names High School in Oakland. We recruited Eva through Girls Who Code, where she was first exposed to computer science. She is interested in how the human mind works, which brings her to computer science and neuroscience. She has already had many public speaking opportunities, including at the EdTech Team Google Summit, where she showed teachers how to use technology in the classroom for more personalized learning. So we're going to kick it off now with, I will ask each of the panelists a question. They will have a few minutes, very few minutes, unfortunately, to answer. And then we will then shift to a general Q&A. So beginning with Dr. Wara. Dr. Wara, in 1969, under 10% of medical students were women. By 2010, almost half of medical graduates were women. You entered medicine at a time when there were very few women, and your professional life has taken place during this transformation. What do you think are the most important reasons for the increase in the number and proportion of women doctors, and how does this affect the practice of medicine in the United States?
Thank you very much, Dr. Symes. So when I first saw this question, I thought it would be an easy one to answer. The longer I thought about it, the more complicated it got. My son advised me to start with data. In the 1960s, 5% and fewer women in medical schools were women. In the 1970s, it's increased to around 15%. 1980s brought it to 25%. And the 90s to around 50% where it stayed. That's a huge change for a field. So why? I, after some thought and discussion with others, think there are three large reasons. The first is that in the 1970s, we were post-Vietnam War, we were far post-World War II, and women were ready and prepared to go out into the workforce, and they wanted careers. So there was a desire on the part of women. To support that, Title IX was passed in 1972, and I should remind you that President Nixon signed into law a law which goes far beyond equal access to sports and athletics. When I carefully reread Title IX, it states that there must be equal access to coursework in high school classes. That's very important, actually, because when I went to high school, math and science were discouraged for women. Now they're encouraged. It's a big change. You have to have high school math and science, I believe, in order to enter those fields, including medicine, at the college and post-college level. Gloria Steinem appeared out of nowhere in the 1970s, and although she was certainly a popular writer, she did help change, I think, women's perceptions of themselves and their opportunities. So society was helping bring this about. The second issue is medicine itself. In order to practice medicine, to see patients, and to be a doctor and a physician, one needs to have a significant number of facts and data under one's belt. That's important. We need to know what we're doing. Secondly, we need to always listen to our patients. Listening is a key component of doctoring. Listening well is something that women do well. Third, we need to collaborate. Medicine is no longer, and doctoring is no longer, the practice by one individual alone to care for a patient. It's really a collaborative adventure between multiple physicians. And so doctors collaborate, and women collaborate particularly well. So medicine was ready for women. We were ready for an infusion by a group of people, women, who would listen well, who had command of the data, and who would collaborate well across fields. That was the second item. The third item, the chairman of my department reminded me of, and that is today. And that is that the financial remuneration for medicine as a whole has not kept pace with law, with other fields such as economics, such as technology. It just hasn't. We're not paid at the same rate, equivalent rate, as physicians were paid in the 40s and 50s and even the early 60s. So my chairman, who happens to be a woman, believes that men are not as interested in entering medicine as now as they were earlier. And there is space, therefore. We've created space for women and men to attend medical school. So it's probably even a lot more complicated than those three issues. If you go back to Title IX, Title IX assures that women will have equal opportunity to participate in athletics. And what does that mean? It means for women that we can learn to become leaders. One leads during athletic participation. We learn to win and we learn to lose. And that is both those items, losing and winning, are big parts of the science of medicine and of the practice of medicine. So that's my answer.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wara. And the only, you've raised many, many interesting points that I'm sure the audience will want to follow up with you. But one point I would like to follow up with you now is, are you implying, are you saying that women are willing to work for less money than men are?
No. And I don't want to imply that women are willing to work for less money than men are. It is right, proper, ethical that women be paid for the work that they do. And that means that women should earn the same, and in many cases more, than men do. We've fought long and hard for that in medicine. We've fought at UCSF for pay equity. I actually led the first pay equity study at UCSF. And I did it, I'm just going to take a second, in kind of a curious way. I met with all the chairs of the departments before I did the assessment, and I said, and I knew all of them, I said, well, you know, I'm certain that you will not want me to come back in 3 or 4 months and meet with you and say that you've got 5 women faculty who are earning less than they should be earning. You're fair and equitable men. They all nodded. Yes, that was true. And an amazing thing happened at UCSF. Within 2 to 3 weeks, mid-level and senior women faculty got enormous pay raises so that these men would not be embarrassed when I started the study. And we've done a number of pay equity studies since, and they've all resulted in bringing salaries closer to parity. They are not at parity. I'm not going to suggest they are, and I thank you for bringing up the issue because, no, I'm not satisfied with women earning less than men. Women should earn what they deserve.
Thank you. I'm now going to ask Dr. Seligman her question to get the conversation going. Dr. Seligman, as a medical doctor in the prime of your career, at the same time you're juggling many things in your life, what do you think women need to think about and do in order to build a rigorous and successful career in science?
Thank you, Dr. Symes, and thank you for inviting me for being here. I want to preface this by saying that I think it is a phenomenal time to be a woman in science and technology and engineering and medicine, because we are able to take advantage of the opportunities that people like Dr. Wara have given us, and they are incredible opportunities, and I think that is illustrated by the fact that when I first started thinking about being a woman in medicine in preparation for this panel, it dawned on me that I haven't thought about being a woman in medicine in quite some time. I am a person in medicine, and I have the same advantages and disadvantages for most of my career as every man in my division and the other women as well. But it still is a time of transition in all of these fields, and there is a lot of variability in the number of mentors available in different fields, both within medicine, and if you look at the disparity in the number of women who are in medicine, for example, versus the number of women who are in engineering. And I think that mentorship is critical. And even in my own field, although I feel like I have many, many other women colleagues, there are very few women colleagues, female mentors who are raising children. And that is important. And I think it's important as we learn how to be the most successful we can be as women in medicine. So here are my couple of pieces of advice. The first one is I think it's absolutely critical that you find what you're really passionate about. And the reason, as I said before, is because STEM careers are hard. They're hard for everybody, not just for women. They may be particularly hard for women, especially if you choose a field where there are fewer women. And the best antidote for overcoming those challenges is being really passionate about what you do and really wanting to overcome those challenges day in and day out. The second thing I will say is that I think the environment you're in is also really critical. So the question was, what can you do to create a successful career as a woman in one of these STEM careers? And I think it's really essential that you find that environment that is supportive to you as a professional and supportive to you as a woman. And that might be who your division chief is, who your boss is, but it also might be the organizational culture of the place where you are. These places are around now. There are corporate climates that are friendly to women, and there are corporate climates that are not friendly to women. It's the same way within the STEM careers, and I think we should find and reward those institutions that are friendly to women by going there and showing what we can do and really contributing the great science that women can do. The third thing that I will say is a practical reality, and I will say that it drives me crazy when people distill women in science down to work-life balance, because being a woman in science is not all about work-life balance. That being said, there are some practical realities to being in a field that requires 10 or 15 years of training. And it's very, very challenging to get to become a physician, for example, or to get a PhD in a science, for example, before you're 30 years old. And there are some practical realities there, and I think we need to acknowledge those. So what can we do here? The first that I think is critical is giving women exposure to all of the variable ways in which you can be engaged in STEM careers, because that exposure is critical for people finding out what they're passionate about. And the second thing is that I think we need to convey to our children and high schoolers and college kids who are considering these careers that having women in medicine is absolutely essential for moving the science forward. Women are asking different questions. They're asking questions in different ways. They're coming up with new and novel solutions. We need men in these fields, but we need women in these fields too. And I think we need to be communicating that. My opinion, being now a mid-career scientist, is that being a woman in these fields is not without its challenges, but it is fun, it's exciting, and I would not have changed the opportunity to get where I am today for anything. So I'm thrilled that we've had these opportunities to create these careers.
Thank you, Dr. Seligman. And both Dr. Wara and Dr. Seligman have made very different comments, but one theme that's cut across both of them is, since you don't know what you don't know, an essential step is to expose young women to these options. But one quick follow-up question to you, Dr. Seligman. You mentioned the importance of an environment that's friendly to women. Could you define what you mean by that?
When I say an environment that's friendly to women, I think it is at all levels. And I'll tell you, as I said before, I don't think about being a woman in the sciences very often. That being said, and no teacher ever explicitly told me I couldn't go into science. No professor ever told me that. No teacher in elementary school or high school ever told me that. But I will tell you, as I reflect back on my coursework, I was one of the few women in my math class. I was one of the few women in my science classes. And I was one of few women in my physics and chemistry classes in college. And that makes a difference. So starting from the earliest ages, I think classes that are friendly to women are classes that show women doing it well. Family-friendly or female-friendly environments, in my mind, are environments that allow everybody, not just women, to recognize that their careers are extremely important, and other things are extremely important, too. And we cannot be well-balanced career people without having the opportunity to surf on the weekends, to take care of our ailing parents, to take care of our pets, or as many women are spending their time doing during these years, taking care of their children.
Thank you. Thank you. And now we turn to the youngest member of our panel, Eva Cole. Eva, while women have made great progress in the medical sciences, as we've just heard, there's been a lot of media coverage recently about the fact that there are still so few women in computer sciences. Could you share with us how you developed your own interest in computer science and what you think needs to happen to get more young women like yourselves interested in it?
So I'll start off saying that the first time that I was ever exposed to computer science was when I was participating in the Girls Who Code program, which I participated in the summer of 2013, which was the very first program that went national after the pilot. And so when I went into the room that day, I was the earliest person because my dad had to get to work early. And so I was there before everyone else. And I was just sitting in that room just thinking about how, like, they said that I was going to learn languages, different coding languages. And I was like, what do they mean by languages? Are they talking about Spanish or like Mandarin? Like, I didn't quite know what exactly they were like talking about, but I mean, I was there anyway, and I was open to it, and I think that's a really good thing, is that girls should feel like they can be open to the idea of being a coder or like sitting at a computer and just working on the computer and like building things, like being an engineer, just like being hands-on and just creating. And so throughout the program, I really realized that I was good at coding. It was something that I liked, and it was like, it was frustrating at times because you have to debug your code, but when you like get your code to work, it's like the best feeling in the world. It's just like you're so satisfied and you're just like, wow, I made this. And so I think one of the main things that needs to happen for girls to get really interested in computer science is just to have that exposure, and to have the option to do it and to keep an open mind when going into an opportunity like Girls Who Code. And so Girls Who Code, actually, their mission, which is to get more girls to major in computer science, it worked on me. I've decided that I want to major in computer science. And I think that also another thing is that girls, people in general, they have something called imposter syndrome, which is feeling like you're the only person in the room who doesn't know what's going on. And everyone else does. And that's what I had that very first day. I thought that all the other girls there, they knew exactly what coding was. They'd coded before. They're probably like some super genius girls. Like, I was actually really nervous. But when I found out that there were girls in there who had no idea really what computer science was either, and that they were there just to find out more the same way I was, and just to see if it connected with their interests that they had previous to the program. And mine was neuroscience, so I came there thinking that, well, you know, computers are based on the brain, so maybe I can learn more about neuroscience. And so I left the program deciding that, wow, like, I can combine these two things. They're both really awesome. I don't think I can choose a favorite. So I think, yeah, also, like, just the exposure, the opportunity, and the resources afterwards. After you've been exposed, I think you should have resources to keep, you know, doing coding, to be able to participate in programs that keep you coding and keep you practicing, because coding takes practice, and keeping up on the new languages and, you know, what's new, and going to like meetups, tech meetups, that's really good, and networking. And I remember one of the key things that Girls Who Code told us, because it was really competitive. It's a really competitive program to get into. And so one of the key things that they said they were looking for in our applications was someone who showed that they were a nice person, just like nice person, not that you had any previous experience coding, just that you were nice, because they wanted to create this network of girls who they knew would continue to talk after the program and to become like, you know, like a family of women who are interested in tech. And I thought that was really big, because I still keep in touch with the 19 other girls who were in my program at Twitter. So I think that was very effective. And just showing interest in things that, you know, are just a possibility. Like, computer science is in your reach, whether you're a girl or a boy. It's equally in your reach. You just have to go out and reach for it. And it's good to try things, be as likely to try, like, a coding camp as you would, like a basketball camp or a sport camp, you know, like just be open to trying the different things, because you may find out that you're really good at it and that you really like it. And it's a really good career to go into now, especially because of the high demand that computer scientists are in.
Thank you, Eva. I love that expression, imposter syndrome. I think it's something all of us in this room probably have suffered from at some point. You paint a wonderful picture of this camp and both the challenges and also how exhilarating it was for you. However, one had to have the confidence or the opportunity to know about it and to apply for it. How do you think, or do you have advice of how that opportunity and that confidence could be spread to more young women?
Okay, so let me think about it. I think that that confidence starts young. I think that parents should also look into different opportunities for their girls. I think that they should say, well, I think you should try this summer. Like, just like get them involved in different things. Like, it doesn't just have to be computer science camps. It could just be a range of different things, just exposure at a young age. My mom and I were talking about this. We were talking about how, like, toys, like even something as simple as a toy. For a girl, most of it is just different shades of pink. For a boy, it's action figures, building blocks, things like that. And so even for, like, young girls, like, give them the option. Like, maybe get them a set, you know, that they have to build their own house for their dolls. You know, like put these little things in there or get them a reading book, because I know there's the toy Goldie Blocks. They add a story in there so that, you know, girls at a young age, they really like reading. So they just add that extra, you know, like it's something that they already like, which is reading, and then they add the engineering perspective on it. And so that gets girls really interested in that, and I know that that's a really popular toy now. And then also, I haven't personally gone through this because I haven't gone to college yet, but during the program, Girls Who Code, we got to speak with a lot of women who went through situations in college where they were, like, the only women, and, like, they now code video games or, like, create video games. And so they talked about how even the professors would be, like, a little, like, oh, like, there's a girl in my class. Like, and then they would come out of it, like, top of their class, you know? Like, that's just how they had to prove it, you know? They didn't overcompensate, but they did what they knew how to do. And I think starting off with the confidence that you're just as capable as a boy at doing something. Because if you start off with this idea that, oh, well, you know, like math is for boys or coding is for boys, or like, you know, just like these subconscious messages that you already have in your head, then you may not be as amazing at it as you could be. So just planting those positive thoughts and those thoughts that you can pretty much do anything that you really set your mind to, I think those make a really big difference in your confidence in your like the way that you can succeed in these fields.
Thank you. I would like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Up the Ladder, Women Pursuing Careers in Science and Technology with Dr. Diane Wara, Dr. Hilary Seligman, and Eva Cole. And I am Dr. Sarah Symes, tonight's moderator. Right now, we come to the part of the program you've all been waiting for, where we open the floor up to Q&A. As Dee Seligman told you earlier, if you are towards the edge of your seats and you have a program, please go stand at the microphone. If you're in the middle, we will pass a microphone out to you. So the floor is open. Yes, please go ahead.
I finished UCLA Medical School, 1967. There were 7 women in that class, 93 people altogether. So things changed. I went back for my 25th anniversary, and it was pretty much 50-50. The other thing I noticed is that there was more people of color. So it wasn't just a pastel class picture anymore. Tell me, you're close to the administration over at UCSF. How much of that was conscious?
That's an interesting question. I think probably 75% was conscious and 25% was interest by people in medicine. But we, beginning in the early 80s, started to aggressively recruit a more diverse student group. We offered summer school, especially to Hispanic students who were interested in medicine. We offered a summer school to folks at UC Berkeley. So that, I have to say, is conscious. But we also have had a bigger applicant pool.
Great. This question is for Eva. You probably know that in the 80s, more than 30% of computer science students were women, and now we're in the almost single digits, somewhere in the teens, so the trajectory is down. I'm really interested in your thoughts on why that's so, and what happened for you as you were growing up. What kind of influences did you have from parents, from siblings, from friends, that you got to where you are now with the confidence that you have, your ability to articulate and even know about imposter syndrome that some of us have just discovered it in the last year or two as it's come out in the news? What the heck happened for you that you are who you are today? Thank you.
So for the first part of that question, why it has decreased, I think it's just, I mean, a lot has changed between the confidence of girls in general, between now and then. I think that women in the 80s probably had a lot more confidence, a lot less standards that they felt like they had to meet than today, because today we have a lot of media influence in our lives as young people. Middle school, I know that middle school is one of those times where girls lose interest in things like math and science. And a lot of that is because of, you know, popularity and things like what's cool, what's not cool. That's really important to my generation. I don't quite know why, but it is. It's a really big factor. So I think for me, I've always been kind of quirky. So that I got over that cool thing pretty quickly. And then I've just met a lot of, I'm one of those, when I was really young, I used to just sit and talk to adults. Like, that was kind of like my thing. I really liked listening to them because I just saw something in them. It was like they had this wisdom and I wanted it. Like, I just wanted to listen and absorb everything that they had to say because I thought I could learn so much from them. So that's basically how I got so confident in a room full of adults, and how I learned so much, because I'm very observant. So that's how I knew what imposter syndrome was, because last weekend I did a panel about STEM as well at my school. And this lady, I never knew what it was called, but I always felt it. I always felt imposter syndrome. But I never knew it was called imposter syndrome until last weekend. And so she was talking about how she felt because she worked at a tech company, and she was like the head of, like, she was like the boss pretty much. And like all the rest of the people who would be in the room with her were men. So, you know, like they would always draw attention to the way that she looked and, you know, like her credibility because she was so pretty and she was like, you know, a woman. So she said that like that was one of the things that she always felt was imposter syndrome. And that stuck with me because that was like my exact feeling. That day at Girls Who Code. So I just get my information from different places because I like to listen and I like to absorb information because I feel like it has some type of value or people wouldn't really, you know, like feel the need to express it because I'm very selective with what I say. So I like to listen. I guess that's a really simple answer. But yeah.
Thank you.
Just really quick, were you really interested in math and
actually,
all the STEM topics?
I'm going to stop you because there's a long line of people. Thank you.
I want to say thank you very much for this multi-cohort panel. You've done very well in addressing what I call the micro kinds of responses, but I'd like your ideas about the more macro, infrastructural ones that would allow and promote women and people of color to continue in STEM. And I say that, and I'll give you a couple of examples of what I'm looking at. You had alluded to Title IX. Title IX, as you know, comes after the Title VI and Title VII of the Civil Rights Act,
right?
You know, which stops discrimination not just on race but also sex. And those were really, if you're talking about Title IX, I think you need to go back to the Civil Rights Act. The other thing, of course, is that for people who went to Lowell High School in the 1950s, what happened is when the Russians put Sputnik up, the girls at Lowell High School, including my sister, were allowed to take calculus. That's and right. Then, of course, because we have to compete globally, the labor force expanded. If we didn't have women and people of color in the workforce, the U.S. could not compete as it can. So I would like you to address
right.
that.
Thank so you. I'm going to ask maybe, Henry, do you want to take a stab or... Dr. Warren,
why don't you try?
Yeah. And then I'd like to get your opinion too. But I will mention just one thing really quickly, which is that I think a lot of the challenge that women have in STEM careers are because of the lack of broad policies that support female careers, and that we are very often at the mercy of individual solutions because of the lack of these fundamental policies that you mentioned. And I'm not an expert in what those policies are, but I will give you an example of one of these individual workarounds that I think was particularly important for me during my three maternity leaves, which happened at a time, as I mentioned before, that are very critical for somebody in research establishing a career. And it's very well known that women are less likely to advance in their careers in medicine and research. They fall out of the labor force, particularly after having young children. One example of one of these workaround solutions is that we have an award at UCSF that gives some financial support to researchers after they've taken a maternity leave, which really recognizes that there is a cost to people's research career. And this doesn't happen just in medical research. This happens broadly in science. That is, we are very fortunate to have the availability of those types of awards at UCSF. And I do think, as I look around at my colleagues and the number of them who've taken advantage of that opportunity, that they are absolutely critical. It is, however, a workaround solution for what should be a broad policy. And people outside of UCSF who don't have access to an individual philanthropic donor, a local Hellman family, don't have access to those types of incredible resources. So in lieu of those resources, we need policy solutions, and for that, you are the expert.
Well, I'll just give you one example. When women return to work after staying home with a newborn, the American Academy of Pediatrics urges breastfeeding, nursing, of babies until they're 6 months old because it's better for the baby. Just is. But if you return to a busy clinical practice, you have to have access to privacy to breastfeed. You have to be given time to breastfeed. The breastfeeding policy, which is very soft in California, says you should be given 15 minutes in the morning and 15 minutes in the afternoon to go pump. It doesn't say anything really. Well, it does now. As of about 3 years ago, it says that you have to have a place to pump within 5 minutes walking of your primary desk. It's taken UCSF 20 years to institutionalize that, and I find that absolutely despicable. I think the toughest time for women is when you return to work after you're now 3 to 6 months of leave. It's a gerrymandered leave. It's a workaround leave. And we need some really forceful policies to support what societally we're saying is correct. We don't have those policies.
Right. And it's a pity that we don't.
It is really a pity that we don't. In a society that, in a country that's as wealthy as ours, that we don't have any institutionalized paid maternity leave, not just for faculty physicians, but for our staff and our nurses. Staff and nurses at UCSF are allowed to take the state-mandated maternity leave, and they're not paid a single cent. Physicians are, but staff and nurses are not. I find it outrageous.
Well, we know what our next panel is going to be about.
So. Thank you. So I work at a kind of a small, medium-sized tech company. And one of the challenges that I've had, especially when I hire for my team, and I run a sales team, is that I get about 4 or 5 male applicants for every female applicant. At least it seems that some of the problem challenge of getting more women involved in technology companies lies upstream. And outside of broader policy changes, which I totally agree with, but can't really personally impact at this time anyway, what are some simple things that I as an individual or as a company that we can do to attract more women to the team?
Eva, would you like to take a stab at that?
I don't know about policies, really. But I know that one thing that tech execs have told me when they've come to speak with girls from Girls Who Code, which is that that if you're qualified, if you're a qualified woman in computer science, then they will come after you. And that when you're getting close to graduation, that you should expect a lot of calls, because tech companies are really looking to add more women to their teams. So I think that the root of it is definitely getting more girls exposed to the point where they want to major in computer science, or who want to major in computer science, because that's where it all starts. And if we don't get more girls interested or get more girls exposed to that field, then we won't get any more girl computer scientists. I'm sorry if that doesn't answer it, but that's my best answer. I don't really know about policies.
Okay, Dr. Warren?
Just a brief word about policy, at least in medicine, academic medicine, which is what I know best. Moving some women up the leadership ladder at UCSF led to recruiting more women at entry levels and their more rapid ascendancy. So I think it's really important, even in a small company, maybe to give a little bit of a leg up to an outstanding woman applicant so that one can begin to build a more diversified workforce.
And I think on behalf of all of us here, I think we thank you for being cognizant and really trying to do something about this problem. And it seems like it will be resolved. If we were having this panel in 10 years from now, you might not have had to make that comment. Anyway, let's hope so anyway. So, next.
Good evening. That actually leads nicely into my two questions, which hopefully will be brief enough that I will not be scolded for asking two. But
well, let's see what they are first.
Sure, certainly, of course. But so I don't know how much of the audience I actually represent, but I am a fairly unorthodox science student. I found it after leaving economics as a major, something traditionally more of a social science and friendly to the ladies, as it were. But I do worry about myself and my compatriots who have an interest specifically for myself in medicine, but other biological sciences and computer science. If the beginning as a middle school girl who is interested in computer science is not available to you, I went to school in Richmond, there were no computer programs, period. are those opportunities still available to you, or is that time sensitivity of, hitting the scary age of 30 very pressing? And Ms. Cole, actually, this is directed to you. Are there places to find these resources if your schools are not necessarily pushing them towards you? And where could somebody who looks up to you potentially find some of these things and maybe move forward as quickly as you have?
Thank you.
So this is a really simple solution, but I use Code Academy. That's one of the first things that I start with, and you can start teaching yourself on Code Academy. It leads you step by step on how to code in different languages. And there are so many resources on the internet now to teach yourself. So maybe you don't have access to someone else's resources, but you definitely have access to something like the internet, which can provide you with basic training in different languages. Because I know right now in my HTML class, a lot of the things that they're doing, they had to learn how to incorporate JavaScript into their websites. So I was like, well, you guys need to go and you need to try to learn it yourself, because there are a ridiculous amount of resources on the internet nowadays, and it's definitely a blessing. So I want you guys to go out and look for it before you come to me and start asking questions, So definitely look into Code Academy. That's probably one of, it's so simple, too. So, you'll definitely learn, and it'll stick with you, and it's a really good way to practice. Also, tech meetups. Look up different tech meetups, and you could possibly find a mentor. and someone who will help guide you or lead you to other resources, to take like adult classes that will have you qualified to work at a tech like company or something of the sort.
Yeah. It also reminds me that for those of you in the audience who are in STEM careers yourself and are women, one of the most important things that we can do is to be leaders in our communities and to be out there and to be showing our successes and our failures and our challenges and the wonderful things we're doing to people at very young ages, elementary school, middle school, high school, college, because you're right, there are many, many, many students out there who still don't have access to role models that prove that we can do this. And so I think it is incumbent upon us as mid-career female STEM scientists that we are really showing our faces and illustrating that this is a successful and fabulous career.
I was hoping to get a word in on this as well. I'm basically a scientist. I'm an immunologist. But I was going to a meeting of women academics in Sacramento in about 1982. My mother, who had been a career woman, marched in the streets of New York, all that good stuff, phoned me that morning, and when I asked me what I was doing, I told her, and she paused and said, "Di, you're finally doing something that's important." And it has stuck with me ever since, that part of what she meant was that part of my responsibility was to get out there and do for others what folks had done for me. And I really, I agree completely with what you're saying. And I think for the mothers in the audience, it's and the fathers, everybody, it's really important to embed a sense of community and a sense of payback and pay forward in our children.
And also I think all of your comments have underscored the importance of a culture of mentorship, yes, at all ages. So,
hi, a quick comment to you, Eva, before I go into my question.
Well, make the comment very short.
It is. It's about 2 seconds. You are cool. Smart is cool and sexy. You did not leave that behind.
Thank you.
And second, I'm one of the mid-level scientists as well. I was 10% of my... about 10% in my engineering studies in college, and I'm currently about 10% in the workforce as well. So I haven't seen the rise that you have been fortunate enough to see in medicine. But my question is, I would love some resources on how to be a mentor and get back into that, because in college I did speak to girls through SWE. The SWE coordinator chased me down the hall and was like, "Oh my gosh, you're an engineering student, you're female, and you look normal." So she wanted me to speak, and so I'd love to get back into that. So I would love if the end result of this was there were some resources for those of us who would like to get back into mentoring. So that's my question.
Help.
Resources. I don't know of any resources. I say look around. Look around you. Find, identify someone, some people with whom you get along well, because mentoring is not restricted to providing a set of guidelines to a younger person or even to working with them on their day in and day out issues. It's really about building a friendship over years. And it's about, talking with a woman or a man for that matter over a 20, 30 year period and helping them build their career just as others help me. So look around and find people.
I do think there are opportunities to be had and really good things to be done by calling the department chief at whatever college is close to you and putting yourself out there and saying, I am happy to act as a career mentor to women or women and men who are interested in going into engineering. I speculate, having done a lot of mentorship myself over the last 10 years, that if you make yourself available in that capacity to college students or high school students, you will quickly run out of capacity to do additional mentoring, because people really do seem to be very hungry for it, particularly, I think, in those fields where there hasn't traditionally been any role models.
Thank you.
Heretofore, we've been talking about medical specialties as one sort of homogenous object. Immunology in particular, compared to pediatrics, has a much lower female share in medical specialties. Do you have any theories on why that is?
Good question. We'll let you take that one.
Well, pediatrics actually has one of the highest percentages of women. So lots of women in pediatrics. Today, probably 70%, 80% of new folks in training in pediatrics are women. Immunology, you know, I have never looked at the data, but I suspect that immunology is over endowed with women. And I wonder if some of it isn't because we go where there are people like us. There were fabulous women immunologists in the early 70s for me to role model after and work with. So maybe it is all about mentoring when you get down to the bottom line.
Thank you.
But then something has to break that cycle, or women have to break in. So use the example of how can we get more women orthopedic surgeons? Hillary, you want to take that one?
That's a really hard one.
I can't answer that.
Here I think it's where it comes down to the environment. And I have to say, the trailblazers have a really, really challenging time in this field. I think that when you find the environment that is right, meaning the division chief, the department head are supportive and willing and encouraging, that creates the opportunity for women to start climbing the ladder. And as women start climbing the ladder, they're able to provide those mentorship opportunities. What that means, I think, is that there is a linchpin here, and the linchpin are often the men who are in control at the senior levels of leadership, and it's really incumbent on them to create that type of environment that feels acceptable for women to be doing this trailblazing in.
Thank you. Yes?
Hi. So both of these questions are for Ms. Cole. And I'm a junior, and I participated in Girls Who Code last year. And I know that I was one of the few girls who have computer science in my school. And so this year, I'm learning Java. And I know that a bunch of the other girls didn't have that resource at school. So I know you mentioned Code Academy, and how else do you educate yourself and stay updated? Apple just came out with Swift, and that's, like, really different. So how do you stay educated and up-to-date? And also, how do you plan to combine neuroscience with computer science? Do you have any ideas?
Yes. Okay, so I did my research on, I'm going to start with your second question because it's the simplest. So I did my research on combining neuroscience and computer science, and I came up with this major called cognitive science. So that's what I'm going to major in when I go to college. And I thought that was pretty amazing how I could just, you know, come up with cognitive science. I was like, wow, it's real. Like, that's me. And so, okay, for your first question, resources. Last summer, I thought I wasn't going to end up doing anything. But I ended up doing a program called BFOIT, which basically it was coding. We learned something called Turtle Graphics, which is based on Java. And like Girls Who Code, we had to come up with a final project and present it and things like that. So you just look into programs. Just research. Like, that's pretty much all you can do. I'm pretty sure you guys got connected with mentors this year, right, as well? So contact your mentor and see if there are any opportunities that you can get an internship. And then look into Facebook, because I know they have high school interns there. So if you keep up to date with your coding and you just practice as much as you can, as much as you would practice anything, and you can apply to like a Facebook internship or something like that. Just keep doing things that will keep you interested until you get to college and you're doing it all the time. So like, that's my advice for you.
Thank you.
No problem.
This is actually kind of for all of you. Two of the tech companies just added like egg freezing to their benefits package for women. It's interesting, I know, I hear all the like hums. And in my company, we haven't done that, but we do have a policy of, like, if you can describe it, you can make it. And I was wondering, like, after all your experience in science and in technology, like, how would you describe the benefits package that you would like to see as a woman? And can we, like, can we make it?
Great, great question. And we'll, I think we'll have each of you opine on that subject, starting with Dr. Warren.
Well, you need to think about what you need from your benefits. I mean, healthcare obviously is first. I think maternity and paternity leave are a close second. And with that comes a set of policies that allow you and to return to work and support you when you return to work. There are all sorts of financial benefit packages. These are tangible things. I think that the intangibles are equally as important. That is, a work environment where you are encouraged, not just allowed, but encouraged to have many outside interests, including raising your children. And I think Hillary commented on this, including taking care of your aging parents. There are lots of things that go beyond aging your children. And if your environment is one that doesn't allow you to join an aging parent who's critically ill, then it's not a really supportive environment. So I suppose vacation leave is really, it's always been important to me because I wanted time off when my children had time off. I think those are the ones I would, I guess I'm not as enthusiastic about egg freezing. I read that as well and thought it was an intriguing, you know, aspect of a benefits package. I know that benefits now include food. You know, I have a nephew who works in the tech group, in a tech group in San Francisco, and he's delivered wonderful food for lunch and wonderful food for dinner, and he thinks that's great. Laundry, I don't think those are nearly as important as the environment that you're working in. And I'm not so sure about egg freezing because there is, you know, there's a wealth of data about the age at which it's optimal to bear and raise children. And I don't think that the evidence is in on the 45-year-old first-time mother.
That's the next panel.
I will add a few things to that. The first is that I have residents come to me frequently and ask me about my experience being pregnant while being a resident. And the focus is always on how do you manage to be pregnant while you're a resident? And I would say this is the same if you're in any high-demand career while you're thinking about childbearing. And my answer to them is always, being pregnant while you're a resident is nothing compared to raising a child while you're pregnant. And we get very focused on these 9 months of pregnancy when the challenging part actually starts afterwards. And I think that we have to stop putting the focus on the pregnancy and start putting the focus on what comes after. So what comes after? I think the number one thing we have to make sure of is that women have access to good childcare. And that means not just 9-to-5 childcare when your child is healthy, because your child is not healthy all the time when they are in childcare, but it means sick care, and it means that your females and your males too have flexibility at work, they have autonomy at work, and that they are not constantly on a state of hyper alert in fear that their child's going to have a green snotty nose, because I guarantee you that that happens when women return to the job after their maternity leaves. So I would say if I was designing my ideal package, it would be great childcare, great sick care for kids, and a wage that helps you support yourself and your husband and whatever additional child care you need, or your partner or whoever else you need, to create that safety net around you to make a demanding job and parenthood feasible. And this, frankly, is the same whether you're in a STEM career or you're in investment banking or whatever else.
Thank you. Eva?
I don't know about egg freezing, but I think that everything that they said seems like it would be pretty nice to have. Because, I mean, for me, when I visited these tech companies, they had, like, kitchenettes, like, every 5 offices. And I thought that was pretty cool already. So, I mean, but what they're saying, you know, if I was to have a child, sounds like it would be really nice to have. So, yeah.
Thank you. Well, it's very interesting that with the panel on science and technology, we have ended at exactly the right time. And I would like to, I'm sure you will all join me in thanking our excellent panel, Dr. Wara, Dr. Seligman, and Eva. We have all learned a great deal from them. We would also like to thank the young women from SEO who kindly volunteered for this program, Jessica Del Rio, Fiora Bella Cogley, and Stephanie Gonzalez, as well as the Wells Fargo for generously underwriting this program. But I would like to offer a vote of thanks for the most important person responsible for this session, which is its organizer, Dee Seligman, sitting there at the back, who worked tirelessly to make this session happen. And we also thank you all, our audience here, as well as those on the radio and internet. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.